Hi, Carlos.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's good to talk to you.
Well, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. I should say for our podcast listeners who don't have any visual aids that you are Carlos Pascual. You're head of foreign policy studies at Brookings. Now, when I think of you, and I don't mean this offensively, I think of parts of the world where things have gone horribly wrong. Not because you caused that, but because before you were at Brookings, you were head of the State Department's Office of, what is it, Stabilization and Reconstruction, or maybe I've got it backwards. But the idea is that your specialty is trouble spots, right?
That's what I've done for a lot of my career, and in the Office of Reconstruction and Stabilization, the intent of it was to create a capacity that could deal with conflict, both conflict prevention and conflict response, in a way that was much more institutionalized for the U.S. government so that it wasn't invented or reinvented on an ad hoc basis every time there was a need for some form of conflict response, whether that was Haiti or Somalia or Kosovo or Bosnia or Iraq or Afghanistan.
Okay, and today we're going to be talking about some of these places, certainly Iraq and Afghanistan. But on this, more abstractly at first, this issue of institutionalization, that is not a favorite thing traditionally for this administration to think about. And I actually don't even know, what years were you in the State Department? Did you overlap? Were you there for part of the Bush administration or not?
Yeah, I was a career foreign service officer, so I served early part of my career in the 1980s with USAID, mostly in Africa. Mostly in the mid-90s at the National Security Council on the staff there, working on the former Soviet Union, and then in the State Department from 2000 through 2006, or 2005,
okay.
Sorry.
And has it been an uphill battle generally, maybe not just with this administration, but to get people to think about kind of institutionalized multilateral structures that can, you know, that can intervene more rapidly than kind of an ad hoc force can, and maybe more effectively, and can take over from there and so on?
Absolutely, because it's been an absolute change in the way that we think about international security challenges. In the 1990s, in a sense, the institutionalization of American policy on this issue actually occurred in one individual, Jim Dobbins, and many of your viewers or listeners probably know Jim, who's currently at RAND, but for much of that time, he was drawn into many of these conflict situations and served as the coordinating point, was the institutional memory on what worked, what didn't work.
He was in the State Department?
Jim was in the State Department. He was at the NSC part of the time. He had served as an American ambassador abroad. He was intimately involved in addressing, for example, the responses in Bosnia and Kosovo. He was the lead of the contact group on Kosovo in 1999-2000. So Jim was intimately involved with these experiences, and he, in fact, was actually very involved in the early stages of Afghanistan and pulling together the strategy for the Bonn Agreement that became the strategic framework for the response in Afghanistan. The problem with that is that you know, one individual is good, but if you don't build up around that individual an institutional capacity that helps learn lessons from these experiences and builds a greater capability across agencies to be able to address these issues and then begins to mount the staff and institutional capabilities to respond quickly, you don't build something that is a requirement for the future. I think the one other thing I think is important to stress is that this is not just an episodic aspect of international security challenges today, that the incidences of conflict where there have been UN missions that have been deployed have vastly increased. There were three times as many since the end of the Cold War in about 1991 than there were the previous 50 years in international experience. And so, you know, these incidences have grown in prominence and significance quite extensively. And I think that they really only started to have a huge impact on the American psychological and security environment really after 9/11. Because what we saw there was that the second poorest country in the world at that point, Afghanistan, became the base for the most significant strike that we had in U.S. territory. And whereas at one point, the United States might have said in certain circumstances, that while we were concerned about the fate of the people of individual countries that were under, let's say, failed states and failed regimes, that perhaps it was not something of direct interest to the United States. And this put a different cast on it, because it created a recognition that if you have a failed state, it can become a platform for international terrorism and organized crime and trafficking of people and narcotics and so forth that can have an impact on our security.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, traditionally, through history, the great security threat to a great power was war with another great power. And the good news is we haven't had a war among great powers, really. I mean, some proxy wars, some dust-ups, but we haven't had great powers, I think, go head-to-head, you know, in about 60 years. And I personally think that is a more manageable problem than it used to be. But at the same time, we do have this proliferation of threats to our security that, as you said, have to do with the internal conditions in other nations. And that's just a fundamental shift in the landscape. And, of course, what the UN was originally most prominently identified was addressing the first threat, you know,
right.
Ending wars.
Right.
And not so prominently, at least. I mean, there may have been, you know, inchoate mechanisms there that have been adapted to these new kinds of problems. But it's really not what the international security system designed after World War II was set up to do, right? And that's why you've kind of found that you have so much work to do. Both, I guess, when you talk about institutionalizing a capacity to handle these problems, you mean both at the sheerly national level, in other words, you know, offices within the State Department and so on, and
right.
also multilateral institutions, right? Those are two separate and related issues.
Absolutely, and both are equally crucial. I think you put your finger right on the issue by analyzing the change that's occurred and the kinds of international threats that we face today. And when you think about the concept behind the United Nations, it was based on nation states as rational actors that were gathered around the table scrutinizing one another in the hope and the belief that that kind of scrutiny could in fact avoid the most egregious behavior between countries. And it's not that that is irrelevant. There are times when that kind of scrutiny is still relevant and important. But now we live in a world where you have non-state and sub-state actors, where you have rogue states who may not particularly care about international scrutiny. You have a change in the concept of transnational threats because of, in part, globalization, but the fact that money and technology can move around the world in seconds and that people can move around more easily in ways that they did before. And so the concept of sovereignty and borders has changed, and that has presented a change in the way that the UN has to think about these issues as well and still hasn't adapted. If you look at it from one perspective, from an American standpoint, we have perhaps the strongest military that we've ever seen in the world. We have a nuclear arsenal that can, in effect, destroy any country on Earth. Yet at the same time, that military might alone is not sufficient to secure our objectives in Iraq or Afghanistan. It hasn't been enough to stop the threat and the spread of global terrorism. And simply switching these issues and addressing them at the United Nations isn't the solution either, because there, in fact, we have under UN consideration Iran, North Korea, Kosovo. The UN has been an essential actor in Congo, in Haiti, for example. Yet that isn't necessarily the answer, because the UN wasn't equipped to deal with those issues either. So, in effect, I think what we're facing is a real set of challenges, both to the multilateral security system and to our own security system, on how we adapt and change in ways that really allow us to effectively address these new kinds of international security threats.
Okay, and let's move to one of these places, Iraq. Now, one interesting thing about you, I mean, the two kinds of solutions that have been batted about recently include the Baker Commission report, which kind of would have combined extensive interaction with Iraq's neighbors in a kind of, you know, institutional framework, and dialogue with them and negotiation with them, combined with a kind of gradual drawing down of the American presence there, and then Bush more or less rejected that and went for what we're now calling the surge. As I understand your position, you actually think there should be a combination of the two, right?
In a sense, but let me complicate matters a little bit further, because where I would start out is by trying to define the kind of environment that one is working in Iraq. And first is a recognition and acknowledgement that it's in a state of civil war. That's not just a semantical issue. It's important because what we have learned over time is that civil wars are essentially settled through political solutions. Whether it's been in Northern Ireland, where the British had to seek eventually a political solution, or in a whole series of conflicts throughout the world, as long as we have had one guerrilla party or two guerrilla parties who are willing to continue to disrupt, maim, cause sabotage, and accept that as an interim outcome, until you've been able to get those parties to buy into some form of a political solution in which they have a stake, it's been difficult to bring that conflict to a close. And it's usually in the context of that political solution that international troops, forces can be most effective in actually enforcing the peace and ensuring the peace. The international forces in and of themselves can't actually create the peace. They can create pressure for it. But until you get that political solution, the peace doesn't become sustainable or viable.
So can I just say, I mean, this points to something I noticed in reading the piece I think you co-authored with Kenneth Pollack,
right,
on this, which is that there's kind of a, I don't know how explicit you were about this, but it came through, there is a real catch-22 here, right, which is that, you know, you can't, the kind of political solution you're talking about requires stabilization, right? And stabilization is extremely problematic with the troop levels we've got there. Am I right so far? I mean,
stabilization would help. It would have helped. You don't always get it. If you think about Bosnia, for example, you eventually got a political solution in the Dayton Accords because people got tired of killing one another. It went on for 4 years, and at a certain stage, they just had to give up, because they realized that they couldn't win. And sometimes that's what finally brings you to the political solution. The tragedy here is that the options in Iraq just simply got worse after 2003. And as the security situation destabilized, as the insurgency grew, as it became more complicated, when it emerged from something that might have been at one stage either a Sunni insurgency or al-Qaeda in Iraq to, in fact, Sunnis and Shia with multiple militias killing one another, and al-Qaeda in Iraq seeking to disrupt everything and everybody, including directly against the United States, that created a much more difficult environment to deal with. And that's where the dilemma comes. Trying to stabilize the situation in that type of environment becomes extraordinarily difficult. And it gets at the second issue that I wanted to raise as one of the realities of Iraq, and in part goes to something that Ken and I wrote about, which is that Iraq is a failed state. And the reason that that is important is that it affects the kind of options that one can look at. And here, I think a shortcoming in the Baker-Hamilton report, and frankly in all of the strategies that have been put forward, including the present strategy, is that it says that we need the Iraqis to lead. And in principle, that's a good thing. We need the Iraqis to, in fact, take ownership for their future. But when you've got a situation where a government cannot provide security for its people, exercise the rule of law, as we saw in the recent executions, even maintain sufficient discipline to actually control those executions and how they were conducted, where you've got police forces that had, in effect, infiltrated the militias. It is extraordinarily difficult to depend on that Iraqi state to fix itself. And so if, in effect, one is calling for Iraqi troops to take more of a lead, if the United States is coming in behind those Iraqi troops and part of an Iraqi plan, one has to expect that likely what you're going to get is that those Iraqis are going to propose a much more sectarian response than we would have, and that sectarian response in some instances might actually make the Civil War worse.
So what's the solution?
Ideally, one would find a way to bring all of the Iraqi parties together to negotiate a truce that they would be willing to abide by that covers some of the core issues that have been a source of grievance, in particular the sharing of oil revenues, how to deal with minority rights, how to deal with the militias and incorporate them into Iraqi society, the relationship between the federal government and the provinces. Those are probably the four big issues. The problem is that at this stage, doing that has become even more difficult than it was before. The Iraqis internally are extraordinarily splintered. Regionally, it has become more difficult to get the regional actors to pull together in a common cause to pressure the internal actors toward peace. Iran has its own particular interests and possibly believes that the Shiites can win and therefore don't have an interest in subduing the Shiites. The Sunnis certainly don't want to see a Shiite-dominated government and therefore don't have a particular interest in seeing the Shiites dominate and win, and in fact may support Sunni extremists rather than see even moderate Shiites come to power. And it presents what seems like an almost irresolvable scenario. All of that said, I think that there is still an argument to be made for attempting a political process that is run with, if not through, the United Nations, that brings together the key regional actors, the neighbors of Iraq, that brings into that equation the United States and the EU, and then creates a broader contact group of interested countries. And from that process, that the international community seek to put on the table a package of understandings revolving around those four key issues that I mentioned before: federal regional relations, oil, minority rights, and dealing with the militias. And that one then seek to get a truce around those issues for a period of about 5 years. Not a long-term solution, but something that will stop the fighting. And in the meantime, the United States and others would have to maintain the current troop presence. I would not suggest a surge in this kind of environment, because if you then get a political agreement, you will likely need a surge of additional troops to actually make it viable, and that's when those additional troops can become most productive.
Okay, so you're not quite pro-surge, although in a piece you wrote with, I think, Michael O'Hanlon, do I have this right, in that piece, you argued that these two are reconcilable. You can have a surge with the kind of regional dialogue part of the Baker Plan, and at this point, given the policy initiatives already underway, that's kind of what you favor, or did I get that wrong?
What Mike and I were trying to outline in that piece is whether or not you think that a regional dialogue is useful in trying to achieve peace in Iraq, which obviously many people question and the administration questions, and one should be skeptical about it. There's still a rationale for having a regional dialogue if you simply look at the regional consequences of the Civil War. There are huge spillover impacts that we're already seeing from the Civil War, including 1.8 million refugees. And with the movement of people throughout the region, we know that in addition to people, that there is a movement of weapons and that there are, let's say, bad individuals who are mixed in with those movements, in addition to just refugees who are trying to look out for their own lives.
And what do the bad individuals do when they, in other words, the bad individuals are crossing borders with the refugees, going into neighboring states, and doing what?
Well, what we've seen in pretty much every major civil war where there have been displacements of people is that you have terrorist elements or insurgents who might move across borders. They may rearm themselves. They may move weapons across the borders. I got to stop here a second. I've got a phone that's ringing, and I got to turn it off. Okay.
That's fine. We our viewers love that kind of, you know, this is reality TV.
It's reality TV.
So they
TV.
Love that. If you can have, like, a big dog come in and jump on you, that would be even better. But you're at your office and not your home, so
yeah, my dog would have loved to have been here. He probably would have bitten my ankles and said, you know, that's enough blathering. I go on to something useful. Anyway, the point that you were getting at, what happens when you have people moving across borders, you have individuals who are moving out of Iraq who might export the insurgency to other countries. You have individuals who may be seeking to rearm and move and get money and move it back to continue to fuel the insurgency. We have seen some indications, but not extraordinarily well documented, about Iran's involvement in supporting Shiite militias. There have been stories about Sunni states supporting Sunni militias. If you get massive movements of people combined with complete instability internally within Iraq, the prospect that that's going to happen and that you're going to get the surrounding states to further fuel that those insurgencies only increases. And so what Mike and I were trying to lay out is that given what we already know about the people movements, about the refugees, about the stakes that the states have in the long term to avoid complete chaos in the region, of the dangers that we haven't seen, for example, the Kurds looking at all of this and saying that they're fed up and declaring an independent state, which then draws in Turkey and Iran in protest and potentially even expands the war. Given those prospects, the prospects for disruption of oil supplies or the spread of international terrorism, that there's a rationale to create a regional process to address these kinds of issues. Immediately, the humanitarian questions, but to create a political dialogue that starts to draw the red lines on what is unacceptable and gets the states talking about some of the problems that they face.
But because really a lot of these states do have an interest in the conflagration not going regional, right?
I think everybody has an interest in the conflagration not going regional because everybody can see the downsides of it. For example, for Iran, if you get a Kurdish state declaring independence, trying to draw in Kurds from Iran, that's only going to create greater instability within Iran and potentially lead to even additional complications with minorities internally within Iran. For Saudi Arabia, for example, they certainly don't want to see the rise of Shiite militias, but in fact, I don't think anybody even wants to see the rise of Sunni militias either. We already had the international experience of the support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s and the way that that helped assist the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and we're still living with that. And so once you set off these forces, they lead to things that are very difficult to shut down and are going to be bad for everybody in the region.
Yeah, and you know, there's an irony in Iran's position, which I only sensed after reading the piece you wrote with Michael O'Hanlon. And it was between the lines. It wasn't explicit, but I realized Iran actually has a little paradox in their strategy, in a sense, in that on the one hand, they would like to expand their realm of influence, and in that sense, you would think they would like to see Shiites taking ground from Sunnis. On the other hand, Ahmadinejad in particular has seemed to be at times playing to the Sunni street, right? I think a certain amount of his anti-Israeli rhetoric, for example, has that political effect of complicating the political position of the Sunni rulers mm-hmm. by rallying the Sunni kind of man in the street to Iran's side. And so, I mean, am I wrong in sensing that these are actually two separate impulses we've seen on the part of Iran, and they may not ultimately be reconcilable, especially if this war goes on and gets bigger, right?
I think you're right in pointing to an Iranian interest in having a more dominant and influential role in the region. It's something that the Sunni elite, the Sunni leadership throughout the region absolutely oppose. And I think that a good example of where this clash has occurred has been with Hezbollah in Lebanon, where Nasrallah has become the most respected, Nasrallah, a Shiite, has become the most respected Arab leader in the Arab world, and in part a leader who has gotten Iranian support. And so there's a dynamic at play here that I think has caused some concern among the Sunni elite of whether or not you can realistically see Shia leadership rising in the Arab world in a way that it is not in the past. And it has created an interest in Iran to certainly see that expanded. The irony for Iran is that it's one thing to be in support of opposition groups or terrorist groups or insurgents or militias whose purpose is to disrupt. When you get into an environment where what you need and what you depend on is some form of stable leadership, then your incentives change and how you handle that situation change. And, you know, there should be a lesson here for Iran as well. If it's difficult for the United States to cope with the Sunni insurgency internally within Iraq, there's no reason why Iran should develop a great deal of confidence that even if you get a Shiite-dominated government, that they are not going to have to face an ongoing Sunni insurgency, and that is going to create its own problems for Iran in the long term as well.
Okay. And just finally on Iraq, before we move on to Afghanistan, so you do not favor a partition-like solution at this point? In other words, dividing the country up into more or less ethnically homogeneous areas that either have immense autonomy or out-and-out national sovereignty?
I do not favor a partition. There's no reason that one should expect a partition happening under stress and duress is going to be a velvet-like revolution like the split between the Czech Republic and Slovakia. This is going to be something that is more like the split between India and Pakistan, where 300,000 lives were lost, and in fact it could, in relative terms, could even be bloodier because it's much more complicated. It's not one nation state seeking to split off, or one group seeking to create a nation state and split off from another. These are multiple sectarian groups with a higher level of arms that are involved that will result in even greater numbers of casualties. If you look at Bosnia and Herzegovina, that division occurred after extensive fighting had gone on for years and where there was a political agreement. And those who have favored a partition in Iraq, from my perspective, have said that it has to happen with, in effect, a political agreement, an agreement on federal regional relations, on the sharing of oil revenues, of reassuring the Sunnis. And if you can get that kind of political agreement, then in effect you've addressed the main political requirement for a solution of the Iraqi problem. And you've set the foundations for the kind of political solution that international troops need to patrol. So in my view, a partition isn't a plan B. It's actually a formulation of a political solution, one option for a political solution that could be put in place in Iraq.
But do I correctly understand you to say that there's no way you're going to get to a state of actual partition or a point where partition is truly viable without a lot more ethnic cleansing, because you need that kind of geographic homogeneity ethnically, or did I misunderstand?
Because there has been not so much that you need the geographic ethnogeneity, but that tolerance is not a word that one can use in Iraq right now. And the fact that Sunni are being driven out of Shiite areas, that if there were many Shiites in Sunni areas, they're certainly not going to stick around. And Baghdad has become an extraordinarily complicated problem between Sunnis and Shiites. And there you even see a conflict between Shiites themselves. Maliki and Sadr believe and support a strong central government because they are from Baghdad. The Shiites from southern Iraq actually support a decentralized state, and so there is no homogeneity in position there as well. So the likelihood of being able to get some form of peaceful acceptance of a divided state is extremely low unless you have a well-negotiated political solution. And if you get a well-negotiated political solution, you're really in a different ballpark. If if what I'm saying makes sense here.
Well, I think, I mean, in a way, so, I guess I was going to ask, so you don't think we could, right now we have enough stability to kind of do the population transfers you'd need ultimately for partition peacefully, right? I mean,
right.
It takes stability to do this peacefully. And one thing you're saying is, look, if we had that kind of stability right now, you wouldn't need to resort to partition.
Let me put it another way. If you were part of the Sunni leadership and those who were behind the Sunni insurgency, if you were presented the prospect of a partition without any guarantees of additional oil revenues or the capacity to share in the country's oil revenues, you would oppose it.
Yeah.
And so you might have a partition where Sunnis are de facto going to the north, but that's not going to stop the fighting. If you were a Sunni, you would continue it because you would say there's no way that you can survive in a Sunni northwest region that does not have access to the country's principal wealth.
So you see the kind of minimum form of national unity that's required as some centralized mechanism for distributing oil revenues.
I think that's got to be a central factor. And in fact, it was the tension over the sharing of oil revenues that helped spark the insurgency even getting worse in late 2005, early 2006.
Okay. Now that we've solved that problem, Afghanistan, you know, the perception is that things kind of started out well right after the war. Things seemed to be holding together. We found this guy that we thought could be a unifying figure, and then things have kind of gotten steadily more precarious. I guess my questions to you would be, first of all, is that accurate? And secondly, if so, it was probably evident to you before it was evident to the rest of us, because you actually pay attention and you go there and stuff. So is that a correct perception?
I think it is a correct perception. Afghanistan is an example of a post-conflict environment that has been radically under-resourced. There is a perception on the part of the United States, particularly on the U.S. military, that this was a mission where the United States could get in, quickly accomplish its mission, begin to hand over to Afghans and to civilians, and it could begin to then quickly scale down its troops and reduce the level of U.S. involvement. I think that that is completely in contradiction with the experience that we've had in other places internationally. If you look at Bosnia and the troop concentrations there, they were 12 ground troops per 1,000 population. The concentrations in Kosovo were 20 per 1,000. The concentrations in Afghanistan were maybe 1 per 1,000. Now, one might argue that different geographic situation, different requirements, but even if you accept those kinds of arguments, when you look at the types of requirements that still existed in Afghanistan to drive out the Taliban, to ensure that you were able to completely shut down al-Qaeda, to prevent the return of those forces, that mission has been radically understaffed militarily, and it doesn't have sufficient resources on the economic and stabilization and reconstruction side. And what is terribly troubling right now is that we're beginning to see a repeat in southern Afghanistan of the syndrome that we've seen in Iraq, where the military, whether that be the U.S. or NATO, comes in, clears out an area. It cannot hold it. Within a couple of months, the Taliban have returned. And in this case, it may be potentially even more nefarious because the drug lords have linked up with the Taliban, have provided resources, and are threatening the population. And people are saying that maybe the first time they might have trusted the international forces to protect them. But now with the Taliban and the drug lords amidst them with considerable resources, it's going to be a lot harder to turn this around the next time. And so if we cannot, in fact, get a significant increase in troop levels and additional resources where civilians can operate in a steady and stable environment and begin sustainable reconstruction in these areas, we have a real risk of losing Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it seems to me this gets back to the theme we started this conversation on, which is that the basic nature of threats to America's security has changed from being one of, you know, other great powers who, right. who you know, we might have war with, to being really originating in the internal conditions of other nations, in particular in instability and turmoil. And it seems to me that the Bush administration, in the immediate aftermath of the Afghanistan war, just had not really gotten that picture. It seems to me Don Rumsfeld was thinking, this is just like the old days. The object of the game is to, you know, make sure that every nation either likes us or fears us. And if you can prop up a regime that can keep, you know, its people more or less under control, then you can, you know, head over to the next challenge and everything will be fine. Which was the way things worked during most of the Cold War. You know, you prop up this regime, and no threats originated from that country in those days, and you didn't have to worry about whether the people actually liked the regime or whether, you know. And actually leads to another thing that I think has happened, that it's actually harder for authoritarian regimes to stay in power. So it's less easy to prop up a regime and say, okay, you're in charge, I'm sure you can handle it from here. But anyway, the broad question is, do you think after the Afghanistan war, the Bush administration still fundamentally had not perceived the shift we were talking about earlier?
I think internationally, it's not just the Bush administration, I think internationally there's not a full recognition of the difficulty of what it takes to actually help a regime that has gone through massive transition and conflict actually survive. You know, there's a certain irony here that Afghanistan became a threat because it was a failed state, and we didn't appreciate what it would actually take to help Afghanistan move from a state that was in conflict to become a viable state. And we didn't appreciate the level of poverty it had. You know, put aside the conflict that they had gone through, this was a place that was at the level of development of Liberia or Sierra Leone. This was not a country that was going to leap from the ashes and suddenly reconstruct itself and be at the forefront of prosperity. And we didn't even remember or look at the lessons that we gained from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, where in 1994, 1995, we still had assistance programs in Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, which were far more advanced. If we look at Russia and Ukraine, countries that had tremendous resources and infrastructure, you know, albeit Soviet infrastructure, it took them a good 8 years before their economies went from year after year contraction to beginning economic growth. So then put that in a situation like Afghanistan, where you have had decades of first a Soviet and then a Taliban leadership destroying any kind of indigenous leadership within the country, destroying education programs internally and the educational institutions, decimating the bureaucracy, absolutely no infrastructure to work with. And you've just gone through this conflict, and what is it going to take to actually restore yourself as a state? And the challenges from a security perspective and from an economic perspective were absolutely huge. Just in and of itself, we should have been expecting that this was going to be an 8 to 10 year transition. You know, look at Bosnia. In Bosnia, there were NATO troops there 9 years after the Dayton Accords, and then they handed over to an EU-led mission, and they're still there. Kosovo, from 1999, there have been NATO troops that are still there. And by the way, the troop concentration in Kosovo today is about 8.5 troops per 1,000 population, greater than the concentration than we currently have in Iraq, which is about 6 or 7 per 1,000, and about 8 times greater than the concentration in Afghanistan. What it tells us is that either, one, those missions in Bosnia and Kosovo were radically overstaffed. I don't think that the U.S. military and the international troops that participated in that would actually argue that that was the case, or that we just radically underestimated what the requirements of transition were from a security perspective and how long it would take to build up the indigenous capacities for local groups to be able to take over.
Mm-hmm. So what do you have a formula for success at this point? I mean, are you, for example, are you in the we need more boots on the ground camp? It sounds like you are, judging by what you just said.
I think we absolutely need more boots on the ground in Afghanistan. I think we need a further internationalization of what of those boots as well. There has been Australian participation, for example, and most of the NATO countries are involved in some way or another. I think 7 or 8 now currently have a military presence. But the total NATO troop presence right now is about 32,000 and then another 10,000 U.S. troops. If you were to apply, say, Bosnia troop concentration levels to Afghanistan, you would need on the order of 250,000 to 275,000 troops. Even if you assume that Afghans could take up half of those positions, this is a radically under-resourced mission. And the only way you're going to get those additional resources are from other countries, such as China. India would normally be a contributor to this, but would not work in Afghanistan because it would just raise additional tensions with Pakistan and complicate the situation further. So I think that there has to be a further internationalization. There needs to be additional resources. We need to regroup and understand the difficulty of the challenge that the Afghans are going through. We need to maintain a much more intensive monitoring process of the developments on the ground, on security issues and on economic issues. And we need to find a way to support the Afghan leadership in order to be able to build internal capacity, because this is a phenomenally difficult task where they have had huge, huge leadership and capacity gaps for decades.
And do you not worry that with a lot more boots on the ground that if we use military force ham-handedly or less than delicately, it will intensify opposition to the occupation as it in some cases has in Iraq?
It can. I think in Afghanistan, one of the things that is fundamentally different is that you have, for the most part, an Afghan people who have a unified view about an Afghan state. There are obviously ethnic differences internally within Afghanistan, but they support an Afghan state and the unity of that state. They have also welcomed international troops. There has been an international consensus about the mission. It is operated from the outset under a UN mandate. Indeed, the United Nations actually put together the international support packages that went to Afghanistan for the most part, obviously with strong U.S. involvement. There already is an internationalization of the troop presence through NATO, and most European troops are involved. There's another particularly important aspect of this as well in terms of getting it right. This is NATO's first and biggest out-of-area involvement that it has ever had. Mm-hmm. And if NATO cannot succeed here, together with a UN mandate under which they're operating, not only is that a devastating signal for the capacity of the multilateral security system to handle these transitions, the signal that it's going to send to would-be terrorists is quite a devastating one. It's basically sending the message that really the international community cannot actually handle these situations on a large scale. So I think we have a huge stake in expanding the mission, but one of the challenges is going to be, can we bring this back to the United Nations? Can we use the UN to generate additional troops? I think that that's one of the critical steps that's going to have to be taken.
Okay. Now, do we have time to talk briefly about Cuba? Or you have to go.
I do have to go, but let's just take a couple seconds on it, because not that we can cover these issues, because I think it's important.
And you are of Cuban descent, right?
I was born in Cuba.
You were born in Cuba. What age did you come over here?
I was 3 years old.
Oh, okay.
So not a lot of memories. Not exactly a strong memory of life in Cuba.
But what's your take quickly? I mean, especially in light of this issue of how long Fidel is going to last and so on.
The fascinating thing is that many of the Cuba experts that have been assembled recently have seemed to come to a similar conclusion, that the succession from Fidel to Raul has already occurred. It's not a question of happening at Fidel's death, but in fact that Fidel has managed that succession already. And those who have been watching Raul and the way that he has handled the National Assembly and the political system are beginning to point to his ownership of that system.
And this is his brother, right?
Right, his brother Raul, who is also 75 years old, and has to recognize that he doesn't have a long life ahead of him either. The interesting thing that this has put on the table is, how will Raul lead? He is not Fidel. In the past, Fidel has generally helped Cuba through unstable situations, and the situation does remain unstable because they depend on Venezuela for $2 billion a year in subsidies, and they have depended politically on Fidel's capacity to keep the political system together through his charisma. And Raul cannot lead the way that Fidel has. He cannot lead by either controlling the society, because he doesn't have the charisma and the credibility. And he cannot lead by exhorting people to yet suffer one more hardship for the sake of the revolution, because he doesn't have the personal credibility to do that either. And we have already seen signs that he has begun to loosen up to some extent on some aspects of the political system. For example, encouraging a crackdown on corruption, encouraging newspapers to talk about corruption and to name corrupt individuals, indicating that there may be some hints on loosening of controls on the internet. And the challenge it really presents for U.S. policy in particular is whether the United States and the international community can help Raul to have, in effect, a Gorbachev moment, an experience where, in the name of glasnost and perestroika, that you start to loosen up on a system and it develops its own dynamic that can no longer be controlled.
Yeah, I'd personally rather he had a Deng Xiaoping moment, given the way things have worked out in those two respective countries. I mean, but that would be a comparison too, right?
Well, that's another possibility of what they may seek to do. But look, you know,
Raul,
from his perspective, is not going to loosen up because he wants to lose control over the society. He will loosen up because he may feel that by letting off some political pressure and economic pressure, he can maintain the controls over that society.
Right, but the contrast would be Deng Xiaoping let the economic liberalization lead the way, and of course the political liberalization still has not caught up entirely, although there's been some correlation. In the Soviet Union, they did it the other way around, leading off with the political liberalization, and although there are a lot of factors at work in both cases, I personally prefer the way China's looking right now, the way the Soviet Union's looking, but... That's a long philosophical...
It's a long philosophical moment, and reconstructing historical moments of opportunity is a difficult, although interesting thing to do. I would just offer one perspective on that. When some of the young young Russian leaders came and said, you know, the state has been the linchpin in controlling the economy of the Soviet Union, and that was the foundation of the communist system. And we now want to break the link between the state and the economy and, in fact, eliminate that underpinning factor that has been the foundation of communism. What is it that we were going to do? Say, well, you know, no, we don't think that's a wise idea. Maybe you should think about this in a 10 to 15-year transition process. I don't think that that was a realistic historic response. So, in effect, you work with the dynamics that present themselves to you.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if we look at the Cuba situation right now, the interesting thing is that it may be presenting opportunities, raising questions about political change and political openings that could occur. And if indeed we, the United States, believe our rhetoric and the strength of democratic and economic processes, are we willing to, in fact, engage with Raul in Cuba in a way that encourages some of those in smart and strategically conscious ways? Are we ready to allow greater travel so that Cubans can see the utility of an alternative system? And are we ready to allow for additional travel in order to get a better sense of those individuals who are acting within Cuba? Let's remember that in the 1980s, we would have taken every opportunity to encourage exchange programs with the Soviet Union to get to know their leadership and to bring them here. We had huge economic programs, particularly food programs, with the Soviet Union. So at the same time that you had Ronald Reagan saying, bring down that wall, that was not mutually exclusive to the kind of engagement that we had with the Soviet Union. In fact, the two, one might argue, were part of what led to the collapse, or at least contributed to the collapse of the Soviet system. So an opportunity to rethink Cuba policy, and it's something that I think we should be spending some time looking at seriously.
Okay, so final quick question. You can even answer yes or no if that's all you have time for. So do you think the economic sanctions were from the beginning a mistake? In other words, we'd be in much better shape if 40 or 50 years ago we hadn't started off on that note.
Yes, I think it was a mistake. We've learned over time that economic sanctions don't necessarily have the kind of impact that we would like them to have. You know, the interesting question might have been that if in 1960 and 1961, when the historical record has shown that Fidel was making overtures to the United States, in particular through Brazil, in order to look at ways in which there might be some form of relationship with the United States, the United States had shown some openness to that. When we didn't, Fidel gave a very famous speech in 1961, if I recall correctly, where he said, you know, I've never read Marx, I've never read Lenin, but in my heart I know I'm a Marxist-Leninist. Financial reality led him to certain conclusions. There might have been an opportunity to rethink that if we had been more open in our policy at a different time.
Okay. Well, Carlos, thanks. This has been great. It's been a rarity on Blogging Heads TV to have somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. Our general model is to have kind of generalist pundits spouting off energetically. And you've convinced me that we need to do more of this.
Well, it's been fun for me. Good conversation, good questions. Thanks, Bob.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.